being what they are, human beings being what they are, people know that there is going to be corruption and that one might as well institutionalize it and regularize it in order to curb it and limit it to a certain amount. So, but it seems that in Iran nobody could accept that notion. So you were talking about corruption, how generalized it was, as it were. Why do you suppose the Shah didn't stop it somehow?
Well, to give him his due, he did rail against corruption, and in contracts with foreign firms, including the one with Molems, he insisted on a clause against corrupt practices being included. His own family, of course, were very corrupt. Eventually he did attempt to curb their activities. I think the Shah must be given his due. Certainly in this respect, and he was, I think, himself very much opposed to corruption. He would see it, I believe, corruption as vitiating good government. And I think he was concerned to try and establish good government. but of course, corruption was always accepted as part of life in Iran. What was troublesome was that it was becoming corruption on such a massive scale, becoming excessive by anybody's standards. Meanwhile, the boom in construction was staving off popular discontent, because so many people were employed in actual building works that there was enough going on for discontent to be kept at bay. If one stayed in hotels like the Hilton and got up in the morning and looked out of the window, you'd see numerous building sites all round, and you'd see the workmen and little boys who worked as well. Villagers, probably. You'd see them getting up. They slept on the site and worked away all day, and were fed, and children, lads who were fetching their tea and so on, preparing food for them. This was fine. It was after 1973 that when a recession began to set in 77, 76, 77, and these building works began to suffer from bankruptcy and to be halted, that the trouble came to a head.
And at that point, it probably was the wrong time to loosen the reins, as it were, and to start liberalizing measures.
Yes, one of the troubles is that Iran, and I would like to say straight away that when I say Iran in this case, one can say a good many other nations, including modern Britain, for example, lives very much in the immediate present. There are never any contingencies. Governments lurch from one ad hoc situation to the next. There's very little forward planning, very few contingency arrangements. Planning in socialist governments, yes, but again, not. Never any planning for consequences of actions. What happens when things begin to go wrong? Government in a high, on a high, so to speak, of prosperity, huge oil revenues coming in, lots of investment, lots of building going on, everybody rushing about creating things. What's going to happen if suddenly the oil revenues go down, if there's a glut of oil on the world markets? and people just don't have to, are not prepared to pay that price. Nobody seems to have any contingency plans. The Shah had no, and his governments had no plans for what might happen if the situation begins to change. What he began to do was somehow to think, oh well, getting discontented because things are going wrong, so this is the moment when I'll relax the severe regime that I formerly maintained. Well, that was just to take the lid off the can of worms. That was to let everything loose.
Yeah, but of course his hand was a bit forced by Carter.
His hand was partly forced by Carter, to a considerable degree, I believe. Carter's presidency of the United States placed the world in terrible jeopardy.
One of the biggest calamities of modern times.
I do agree with you there. Also, I think the Shah was beginning to realize his appalling illness, one of the best kept secrets. And beginning to think very much in terms of the regency, and thinking perhaps that he should mend fences with his subjects in order to leave a happy situation for his son. I think these were factors operating in his mind. And then, of course, the gradual realization that it wasn't working that way, and that people were beginning to show their resentment and criticism of his regime, I think completely broke him. Of course, finally, he was left a broken man, as he had been at one period during the Sadiq's regime. I remember Said Enjebi, who was running a newspaper in the Sadiq's regime, being sent for, describing how he'd been sent for by Muhammad Reza Pahlavi, and meeting a man who had prematurely aged, was shuffling along in carpet slippers, totally broken, begging of Enjebi to use his newspaper in favor of the court of the Shah, actually showing him money, bales of money, and saying, you know, this is yours if you will do this and that. So the Shah was essentially, I think, a weak man, could easily be broken by circumstances. And was, of course, very badly broken by just a failure to know what to do, conflicting advice, waiting for instructions from the United States as to what best to do, and getting conflicting advice from them. Because, of course, there are so many United States, aren't there? Not, I don't mean the actual states of the Union, I mean governments. There's the Pentagon, there's the State Department, and there's the White House. Not always acting in unison. In fact, very rarely it seems to me acting in unison. We're just having a classic example of it. Weinberger saying one thing about New Zealand and Schultz saying another. Well, this was the kind of thing that the Shah was confronted
with. But anyway, why should she listen to them? I mean, why should he listen? He was a sovereign. Why should he listen to them? Yes, this is the strength of Khomeini.
He suddenly says,
I'm not going to listen to anyone.
No idea what to do. And no advice from anyone, except that he should go on holiday. That was the principal advice apparently the British and US ambassadors gave him towards the end.
Only because there was no other choice.
There was no other choice. Gradually, an Iranian people who'd been kept in a degree of suppression for, 50 odd years, gradually saw their chance to come out and reassert themselves. That is what happened. It's very sad.
Yeah, but the reassertion lasted a few days. Look what they're doing to them now.
Yes.
It's children's tea party compared.
Yes.
But the Shah may or may not have done to people. It's absolutely nothing compared to...
was less capriciously, less arbitrarily cruel than the present one. At least one knew that if one did certain things under the Shah's regime, certain unpleasant things were likely to happen, as in the present regime, nobody ever knows when they may be those who are made victims. might be because you're smoking the wrong kind of cigarette, or because you're listening to a cassette, playing Western music in your motor car.
Or wearing a tie.
Or wearing a tie. There is disaster in the present situation.
But you see, Khomeini now doesn't say, well, I am going to listen to anybody's advice. You see, all Iranians, as you say, believe that there is always the hand of the foreigner. And this man was canny enough, Khomeini was canny enough, to realize that it's not the hand of the foreigners. It's jolly well the people themselves, and that he could do what he wanted, while allowing everybody to think that it was somebody else pulling the strings.
Yeah. In the 50s, when I was living in Iran, one of my closest friends was Ehsan Naragi. Extremely clever man. Well, he went to jail, he was sentenced to jail for 12 years, or 7 years, I'm not quite sure which, but Banisadr effected his release, and he's all right. Banisadr had been a pupil of his in Paris. Ehsan was a clever and a witty man, and he and I used to discuss in 56, 57 the future of Iran with extreme foreboding. Quite looming, foreboding. Well, I always remember I used to say, well, who would take over? And Ehsan used to say, there are 7,000 colonels in the army, and neither you nor I know the name of which one it would be, assuming that it would be a military coup. And I'm still not sure that ultimately, even after the revolution, the final solution may not be a military coup by one of the numerous colonels in either the Iranian army or in the past Iranian Galabi, the revolutionary militia, or whatever, ultimately the military person. Perhaps one of the reasons why they wish to continue the Iraq-Iran war is that they're not quite sure what might happen when all those fighting men from the frontier are left unoccupied with the frontier business and turn their attention towards the capital.
Well, of course, every revolution does need a Napoleon.
Exactly.
I mean, somebody has to come forward and save it.
Yes.
Save the country.
Yes.
From it.
Well, yes, that's one way of putting it. But the young officers at the head of Savak, two of whom I knew, they used to complain to me about the corruption of the older statesmen of Iran, and tell me that it was these men the Shah most deplored. Well, I suppose they were thinking of some of the old hangers-on members, those men who were put into higher committees, Shura Hayye Ali, of which there were a number made, I always believed, as slots in which to pit aged senators and much less deputies.
And they were corrupt?
People like Asadi, Khorasan, and those people, no, not necessarily. A lot of them were not so corrupt. Corruption was, I think, very often a characteristic of people described as Tazebedoran Rasidis, people who parvenu, as upstarts, who were more likely to be corrupt. A lot of the older statesmen, people were far too dignified and far too rich anyway to need to be corrupt. They were people, khanavadedar, they had families. People knew who their fathers and mothers were, to use the common expression.
What about some of the old politicians? Did you ever meet some of them? For instance, the two Entezam brothers.
Yes.
I mean, Abdullah knew very well, and he was a very wise and good man, great friend of Hoveyda's, and he said that he couldn't talk about anything political with Hoveyda, that he was just totally closed to any suggestion.
Yes. Well, the Entezams were exceptionally fine. Yes, I did know them. They were exceptionally fine men. There were others. I knew Matin Daftari quite well, too. He was, I think, a lightweight, but he was a man of great integrity and seriousness.
And he was put aside?
Yes, he was an ascetic son, of course. Yes, he confined himself to being the head of the United Nations Organization. father of Hidayat Masih Daftari, who became a politician and tried to form one of the parties that emerged during the after the revolution. He's now, of course, living abroad in Europe in exile, after a period living in hiding in Iran. Of course, I knew him and the younger generation, Parviz Raji and young men like that. They were sort of children and protege of mine, people whose parents I knew and who used to come and see me when they were on holiday from their universities in England, Cambridge, in the case of Raji and Matin Daftari, both of whom were up at Cambridge University. The older people, yes, I met numerous members of the old political circles, whose names I can hardly remember now. Said Ziauddin, of course, I used to go out and see quite often. He was a fascinating character. But with him I talked mainly about the past. I mean, I got him to tell me his experiences of making a coup d'etat. The coup d'etat of February the 21st, 1921, he said was his coup d'etat, but it was the coup d'etat that, of course, brought Reza Shah to power. He, generally speaking, deplored the lack of development of Iran's natural resources, agricultural resources particularly. He was very much a back-to-the-land man. He wanted the Shah to encourage farming. He deplored the importing of meats and of grains in the country, which he said should be self-supporting in both. In lamb and in grain. He was also a neutralist, really. He always had been, after all. He believed in equal-handed friendship towards the Soviet Union and towards the West.
Non-alignment.
He was keen on that. But of course, he had apparently no power. Though he did talk to the Shah, I think about once a fortnight he saw the Shah. And I think in those days, this was in the 50s, he was still in a position to make himself heard by the Shah. Not until after 63 that the Shah became impervious to counsel and advice from people like Said Zia. Though it was already in 1950 that people like Ibrahim Haji Nouri, a senator, vowed that the Shah had said he would never be a senator, selected as a senator again, because he'd spoken to the Shah, as I mentioned on an earlier tape, in terms of the necessity of the Shah reigning rather than ruling. Then, of course, one met beautiful old men like Nizam Sultan, who'd been one of those ambassadors unwise enough not to receive the Shah when the Shah fled the country under Mossadegh's government. Of course, some of the ambassadors forgot, as I told Nizam Sultan, that they were appointed to as ambassadors, as a Safiri Kabir. They were appointed by the Shah, not by the Prime Minister. Nizam Sultan in Rome had misinterpreted the terms of his farman, of appointment, and when the Shah arrived in Rome, had failed to greet him, so he was...
But isn't that disloyal skunk behavior?
Yes.
It makes me boil!
Yes, well, it made the Shah boil too, so poor old Nizam Sultan was left in exile in his country place, at a place called Galanduyak, outside Tehran, where one visited him and where he played at being a Sufi, but I think only played at being a Sufi. But anyway, he had the Farman framed on the wall. I said, look at the Farman, didn't you read it? See what the terms were. We, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, appoint you, and so on. He was very contrite, very repentant of what he did, and always hoping for a reconciliation, which half-heartedly, I think, in the end came. The Shah wasn't as vindictive as a lot of people have accused him of being.
Well, he wasn't vindictive enough, really. Otherwise he would have got rid of Khomeini.
Yes. Then, of course, one knew Hassan-e-Pakhravan very well, the that rare phenomenon of the very, very cultured military officer, fond of poetry, highly literate, marvelously influenced by his French mother, Amine Pacheraman, or French grandmother. Very cultured and pleasant man, and talked a lot with him. And of course saw Hoveyda quite a lot too.
So, but Pacheraman was very loyal, so, and at the same time as being very cultured and intelligent.
Yes.
And he was the head of the Savak organization. So what was his assessment of the situation? Surely you could talk to him.
Well, I did. We talked very frankly. Pacheraman's appointment to Savak was a hopeful sign. Seemed to indicate the possibility of some kind of relaxation of the severity on the Shah's part. He was a liberal man. No torturer he. He was not the kind of man whom one felt uncomfortable in the presence of and wondered whether he'd be capable of taking one's fingernails out one by one. Not at all. He was a very mild and congenial man. But of course he, like everybody else of any intelligence, was afraid of the Shah's arrogance. An arrogance in which, I must repeat, the Shah was very Iranian, very much like many young Iranians. The Pahlavi regime spread arrogance. A lot of people became very arrogant. Young men behind hotel reception desks, very arrogant, very rude. I remember my horror in 1975 when I was there with an international conference sponsored by the Empress and Hoveyda. I remember being so perturbed, so shattered, when some of the American delegates to this conference came to me and said, you're an expert on Iran. Can you please tell us why Iranians are so rude? And I said, but to think that I should have lived long enough to be asked this question about one of the most scrupulously courteous and polite nations in the world.
Exquisitely.
But they said, but exquisitely polite. But they said, but we don't see it. I said, no. I said, because they're giving back to us. The manners that they have seen us display. I said they've presumably seen casual hotel receptionists who turn their back on the customer and hand them their key in surly silence or whatever. And because I saw this kind of behavior, so un-Iranian. But then these young men behind hotel desks were in an un-Iranian situation. It was all an artificial Western situation. In a Western-style hotel, it wasn't Iranian at all, so they didn't behave like Iranians. I did myself go quietly to there and have a quiet word with them. I told them, I said, these people think maybe Adam has been. And sort of cajoled them, and then they were, you know, made a bit of a joke of it. And I said, be a little bit more merry with them, and so on. But there was this arrogance, but it was the arrogance of a people who, deep down in their subconscious, were, I think, confused. They were in a world that wasn't their world, and which they didn't quite understand, because these young men weren't highly educated people, but they were put clapped into a uniform, nice blue jackets and trousers, and put into this strange position. Sometimes they were very amusing. I mean, sometimes, of course, they were quite obviously agents or part-time agents for the security organization. I shall never forget myself arriving on one occasion at one of the great hotels of Tehran. I wasn't, in fact, staying at it at that time. I only stayed in big hotels like that when I was somebody's guest, a government's guest, or something like that, which I was once or twice. And I shall never forget arriving. I think I was going to see somebody at the Hilton, I think it was. And one of these boys behind the reception desk says, Salaam alaikum, ahayyri. Shawain dafe sharam imini. I said, I've never seen the Shah. What on earth do you mean? And they sent for you, and so on. Well, he was a boy, oh, first of all, I didn't know him, but he knew who I was, so he was rather, I think, giving his role away. He was obviously somebody who had been informed, been advised to look, watch my movements, and whom I was visiting and seeing, and so on. So there was plenty of that going on, which led to a great deal of distrust. I mean, Seipel, in his book, one of the numerous books that's been written about revolutionary Iran and Iran on the eve of revolution, remember one of the points he made?
Who's?
Amin Seipel, an Afghan journalist, now a lecturer in Australia, but his book was published by Princeton. One of the points he makes is the degree of suspicion, the rifts and divisions in society that became characteristic of Iran in the later years of the Shah's reign. Suspicion.
Because generally Iranians, rather like the Russians in fact, are a bit paranoiac. So
yes,
if they have a good reason to be, then it really gets out of hand.
Yes.
Everybody, one was told that one's gardener.
Yes.
Was a member of SAVAK. He was nothing of the sort, but
yes,
it's just exaggerating.
Yes, they get very mutually suspicious, very paranoid.
But Russians are like that. That's why they are so, you know, they can't handle really the international situation at the moment.
Yes. And of course the other problem is that Iranians always, I think, tend to believe they're living in an Iran-centered world. It's so that they're convinced that Iran is of infinitely greater importance to, for example, the governments of the United States of America or of Great Britain or of the USSR than in fact it is. Naturally, this is a theory that is somewhat given enhanced credence by the role played by students of Iran like myself. I mean, we think about Iran, talk about Iran in a way that must make people think that we believe Iran to be immensely important. And there is a tendency, Iran has a kind of aura, a cultural aura, a splendor of legendary history and actual history, to create a tendency in the world to regard Iran as very important. Iranians themselves are certainly immensely imbued with a sense of their universal, their cosmic significance. I think all this is exaggerated. But I will say, of course, that there is a perennial quality about the products of Iranian genius that does, of course, give it a certain special aura in the field of culture. It's an aura that it shares with the ideas, I use the word ideas deliberately, the ideas of Greece, ancient Greece, and the idea of Italy, Renaissance, if you like, Italy. These, Iran, Greece, and Italy, and for this reason I like to preserve the use of the word Persia, because of course for the European, Iran is Persia. The Greeks, as the first impresarios, so to speak, of Iran for the Europeans, called Iran Persia, using the name of a part for the whole. Whereas, of course, Iranians, as I constantly have to explain to Westerners, have always called their country Iran and thought of it as Iran. So I like the word Persia because Persia, Italy, Greece, are words in European cultural concepts which stand for a special cultural area and for a special series of cultural phenomena. One doesn't think of Iranian poetry. One doesn't think of Iranian rugs. One thinks of Persian poetry. One thinks of Persian rugs. And one doesn't think of Hellenistic poetry, Hellenistic drama. One thinks of Greek drama, Greek tragedy. and similarly, Italy has this is a word which for me spells paintings, art, terraces with balustrades and urns on them with flowers drooping down from the tops of the urns, from the earth within the urns and so on. All this cultural the delicacy, the filigree, the changing patterns and colours of rugs, the marvellous intricate meters and the enamel-like imagery of Persian lyrical poetry, all these things which are of such importance and such a paradoxically perennial hardness and toughness and resilience. For they survive when kingdoms, shahs, governments, schemes for the getting of oil, for the exploitation of areas, have all collapsed. These threads, as it were, these silver threads of cultural truthfulness and reality continue. And this is why Iran continues to be of such immense importance to me. I've just discussed the fact that it's not as significant as people think it is. Now I'm telling you that in fact, of course, in a different area, on a different level, it is of vast significance on this cultural level, because its poetry, its literature, and its artifacts have a truthfulness.